In January 2021, Paris lost one of its most legendary countercultural figures, Jim Haynes. I got to know Jim quite well towards the end of his life and was delighted recently when I rediscovered this interview I did with him almost a decade ago now. In it, he talks about his childhood in Louisiana and Venezuela, opening the UK's first paperback bookstore, his friendship with Henry Miller, the legendary 1962 International Writers Conference, London in the 60s, hanging out with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, the demystification of sexuality and art, where the sexual revolution went wrong, founding the International Times, Suck Magazine and the Wet Dream Film Festival, travelling on a world passport, the May 1968 protests and, if you can believe it, much more besides. I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed talking to Jim.
I never had any money. I built a bookshop and I built a theater and started a newspaper and did many, many things. And people thought, you must have come from a wealthy background. I never did it with money. I did it with just words, talking people into giving their time and their energy and their labor and their skills and everything, and telling them the reward. Well, actually, the philosophical orientation came from Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer, because I don't know if you remember the famous episode, I think it's in Tom Sawyer, Whitewashing the Fence. His aunt says, you have to go out and whitewash the fence, and it's a hot day in Missouri. And it's the last thing he wants to do, you know. But he goes out and he's whitewashing away and he's whistling, and his friends come up and say, what are you doing, Tom? He said, I'm having fun. And they said, well, we want to have fun, too. He said, well, what do you give me? And they said, well, we'll give you a ball of string. He said, okay, you can whitewash it. You give me a ball of string, you can whitewash it. So that's what I did. I created a situation which was fun, and everybody wanted to have fun. And that's how the Travis was built, the bookshop was built, the newspaper was created. Everything was built on Tom Sawyer.
One evening as the sun went down and the jungle fire was burning, down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for a land that's far away beside the crystal fountains. So come with me, we'll go and see the big rock candy mountain.
In the beginning, my God. I have no idea where it all began. I've always been an optimist, incurable optimist. I've always liked to see the glasses being half full, and I've definitely have not been someone who judged anything, judged people. I've been more into the accepting mode. Well, that's the way it is, kind of thing. I was born in Louisiana and grew up in Venezuela, went to boarding school in Atlanta. I wasn't a brat. I was super curious about the world, super friendly with all my neighborhood neighbors and encounters and shopkeepers, and I knew them all and by their first name and would go and see them, and totally independent. My mother and father didn't know what to make of me. But they accepted because they couldn't do otherwise. I wouldn't put up with anything otherwise. I was totally determined that I would live my life the way I wanted to live it. And people say, was there a role model? No, the only thing I can think of is a love of reading. I loved reading, but I also loved meandering and wandering around, exploring my neighborhood and neighborhood, meeting all the people. No, I have absolutely no religious orientation, desires. No, not at all, not at all. A certain amount of pressure was put on me to go to church, and I think I went a few times, but I was bored with it. Yeah, I find it boring, extremely boring, and I was very much an atheist, agnostic, not interested in organized religion at all, of any kind. I've never been interested in whether it's, you know. And my mother and father were absolutely, didn't force the issue at all. They accepted it. I mean, they weren't as probably as strong as agnostics as I am, but or was, or am, yeah, am still today, they just accepted that that's the way their son was, and they had produced a strange son. And this is what I always say, and maybe it's true, that when I was a big reader, and my father had a few interesting books in his library, and I used to read them, and two books in particular were major influences. One was a book of poetry by Dorothy Parker, an American poet who I am very fond of still today. And she wrote amazing things about romanticism and love and the doom of it all, and it never coming through, and she was very much a pessimist. Other influence was a black American poet, so poetry was really major. Langston Hughes, and Langston Hughes was wrote one poem which was someone growing up in the South was extremely powerful. It was called "I Too Sing America." And it goes something like this: "I too sing America, I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I grow strong, and tomorrow they'll see how beautiful I am. I too sing America," and goes on in that vein. And it was very moving. And so I was never a racist. In fact, I was, from a very early age, fought against racism. Mm-hmm. My mother and father were not racist particularly, but, you know, there was definitely a white society and black society. We had maids, and I was always very respectful and interested in their life and everything, and paid attention to them and talked to them and mm-hmm. everything. And then when I went to South America, which is very much a mixed culture, I mean, everybody's all thrown together, black, brown, white, you know. So it was further reinforced my anti-racist. And then, yeah, I had my bookshop in Edinburgh. Well, what took me to Edinburgh is I went in to do my military service. At the end of 2 years, I asked permission to be released from the military in Edinburgh. And to my delightful surprise, it was granted. And I continued to live in Edinburgh. But much more modestly, because when I'd been in the military, I had received an income. Mm-hmm. Suddenly I have no income. But I had saved a little money, and the only way I thought of survival was to start a bookshop. So I started the so-called first all-paperback bookshop in Britain, mm-hmm. and it was appropriately enough named the paperback. Well, because I had a gallery and a theater and coffee house in the same place. Mm-hmm. It was like an old... I was inspired by what I thought would be a great bookshop. It was my own. It was actually a perfect location. The old university was here, the new university was here, and I was in the middle between the two. So every day about a few thousand students had to walk in front of the bookshop. And since I gave away free coffee and free tea, and the regular customers had their own private cups hanging on the rack in the back, they just went and made themselves a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. It attracted a large student clientele. And I gave the address of welcome every year to the freshman class. So I was quite a well-known character around Edinburgh and the university. So it was a very popular bookshop. And then on the ground floor, well, it was a ground floor and a basement. In the basement, I had a gallery. And on the ground floor, I had Hessian drapes, which could be dropped at night over the bookshelves. So it became a performance space. I did plays in the bookshop and concerts and book signings and whatever. So it was a hive of activity at all the time. And it was a much-loved institution. And when the university expanded between the... they connected the two parts of the... they knocked the whole block down. And many people were really, really upset in the city because of the bookshop was so popular. It was a major source, intellectual center in the city. It attracted people from all over Scotland and the north of Britain, and indeed Scotland, indeed, you know, Oxford, Cambridge, and London, because I sold books that you couldn't get anywhere else in Britain. Many censored books and illegal books, whatever, like Tropic of Cancer and Fanny Hill and whatever, you know, D.H. Lawrence. I sold D.H. Lawrence, Lady Chatterley, when it was banned, and a woman came in and heard, said, I hear you're selling this book, and could I buy it? And I said, yes, and so she paid me. She said, I'll come back in 30 minutes to get it. And I smelt a rat, so I called a photographer friend of mine. I said, I think we're going to have some action. And she came back in 30 minutes. My photographer friend was there, and she picked up the book with a tong. She wouldn't touch it, and carried it outside, and poured kerosene on it and burned it. Wow. And ran it and raved. Meanwhile, he's snapping away, and the pictures went around the world. I sold books that were, I guess, were pursued my philosophical and political aims. Yeah. And I sold a lot of poetry, a lot of philosophy, and contemporary fiction, and contemporary, yeah, it was a great bookshop. It was really a great bookshop. I mean, I ran the bookshop because it was a fun thing to do, and I liked the idea of creating an ambience which was warm and welcoming. I met all my customers and knew their names and introduced them to people, and out of it came love affairs and marriages and babies, and not specifically for me, but for my customers. I remember I introduced a philosopher in Edinburgh that I liked to a woman that I liked, and now they've got kids, you know. How many booksellers do that? And now this university are putting up a sculpture or monument to the bookshop this August during the festival. I have to go and cut the ribbon. I mean, it's nice that people cared, you know. It's nice that people cared for what happened. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of history, but I actually have been extremely fortunate in that most of the people that were influences in my life I later met. Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer was a major influence, as you know. Sure, yeah. And I later got to know Henry pretty well. Tropic of Cancer is very interesting in my life because I read it 4 times and in 4 different cities and at 4 different ages. You know, I read the first time when I was a teenager almost in America, and the second time I read it in my 20s in Edinburgh, and I read it in my 30s in London, when I lived in London, and I read it in my 40s when I moved to Paris. Now, the book is the same book. You know, you don't change the book. It's the same book, but it was a different me. I was a different person, all those in reincarnations or whatever. And therefore, the book had a different meaning for me each time. What really got me all 4 times, I think, was his incredible passion and love of life. You know, life is short, mean, bitter, full of injustice, pain. You know, we can list all the negative things for a long time. And but in spite of the fact that he was totally broke and with no prospects, he was a tremendous love of life and extremely happy with his situation. And Henry liked people. He liked everyone. I mean, not just the people who could do him some good, or he liked everybody, every person he met, you know. And I liked some of his stories of meeting prostitutes on the street, down and out prostitutes, and befriending them and becoming friends with them and everything. When I lived in Paris, I knew the streets he was walking down, and sure, I'd also met him by that time. I met him in Edinburgh. Indirectly it came about through the bookstore in Edinburgh, but it really came about through my friendship with John Calder, and he and I organized a writers' conference in Edinburgh in 1962, which was an amazing event, probably one of the most incredible events of my life. Because we we talked the director of the Edinburgh Festival into kind of supporting and backing it. And we invited 70 novelists from all over the world. And they all came to Edinburgh. And unlike most writers' conferences today that take place, where people come for an hour, give a talk, and then leave, we had all 70 writers together for a week on the platform, at lunch together, at dinner, at party and dinner that night, and it was totally unscripted, and nothing was scripted. It was all spontaneous, whatever anyone wanted to say, and it was quite an event. And that's when Henry came, for various reasons he came, and he was actually in a way the star of the conference, although he didn't say very much. He was a very modest fellow, and a listener. And not a big talker, but he could talk, but he liked to listen, and he liked to meet people and hear what they have to say and everything. And why I say he was the star there, because everybody there was a big admirer. You know, there was Norman Mailer and Mary McCarthy and Colin McInnes, and you name it, they were there. Lawrence Durrell was there. So it was quite a gathering of people. I ran it a number of years, and then my problem is that I fell in love with an actress, and so I started a theater for her. And in fact, she never performed in it. She became a big Broadway star and television and film star in America, and she never performed in the theater I started for. She's seen it, she's been to it, and we're still friends today, I'm pleased to say. And the theater will be 50 years old next year. It's the Traverse Theater, yeah. It's the mid-60s, 65, 66. The Minister of Culture in Britain at the time was a woman called Jenny Lee, who was a Scot, actually, and came from a fairly poor background and has risen up through party politics to marry Nye Bevan and became a very much an honored woman in the Labour Party and in Britain and everything. And through a series of serendipitous accidents, I met her, and we bonded and became quite close friends. And I'm like a 25, 30-year-old kid. Well, and she's like, you know, the grand dame of British Labour Party, and we're friends. I mean, it's like the unlikely a friendship as you can imagine, you know. But she and I got on very well. I was invited to speak at a conference on the problems of the small theatre. And it was in the southeast of England, like in Colchester, I think, the town. And I went to the conference, and I gave my talk. And Jenny Lee, who was a Minister of Culture, also gave a talk. And then afterwards, there was a cocktail party at the end of the conference, 2-day conference, I think, or something like that. And I met her, of course. I was introduced to her. And I boldly said to her, I said, I think I even used her first name, Jenny. I said, are you by any chance driving into London? Can I hitch a ride with you? And that's an extremely bold thing to say, you know, to ask. And she said, well, yes, sure, I'm driving into London. You can have a ride with me. And so between Colchester and London, we bonded. It brought me to London because there was a theater in Holborn called the Janetta Cochran Theater. This is a word I don't particularly like, but White Elephant, you know, it had never been successful. It had been built a certain amount of money had been put into it, and it just sat there as unused. And the few times it had been used, it had been a semi-disaster. So Jenny said, look, you can animate it. You've got the skills to animate this theater. Can you come to London and put it into life, bring it into life? I said, Jenny, I can't say no to you. I'll do anything you want me to do. But I don't want to give up Edinburgh. And since she was a Scot as well, and since she was extremely proud of the Travers, she said, well, I understand that. You can do both. So when I went to London, I was running two theaters, Edinburgh and London. Well, London in the 60s, and I was one of the movers and shakers of London in the 60s, no doubt about that. It was very much a land of opportunity. There was so much and Edinburgh too, for that matter, in the 50s and 60s. There was nothing there. Britain was just recovering from the Second World War, or as was Europe. And so everything was possible, mm-hmm. and rent for cheap, and no one had any money. I've never been that music-oriented. Mm-hmm. Rock and roll didn't mean that much to me. I liked the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. I knew them all personally, and I liked them and everything, and Pink Floyd and everything. But I haven't been a music fan, and I haven't been a druggie. I didn't smoke, I don't drink alcohol, and I was never interested in the drug culture. But I was interested in sexuality. I used to say sex was my drug, but I wasn't really interested in notching up, you know, another score. You know, I was interested in tenderness and increasing the amount of tenderness in the world. And also I was interested in demystifying sexuality because I blamed romanticism for endless amounts of pain. The woman prepares her whole life for the prince, and she doesn't realize there are no princes. And the man goes looking for the princess. He doesn't realize that there are no princesses. And so they're both disappointed. You know, I said, why not just be tender and loving with everybody you encounter? You know, don't wait, woman, by the telephone for the call to ring. It's never going to ring, or, you know, you'll wait your whole life away. Pick up the phone and call somebody and say, let's go out to dinner or whatever, you know. And I was very much interested in, I have a one-sentence definition of liberation, which goes for men, women, and children. But I wrote a book, which I've never published, called Women's Liberation, a Definition. And the definition is one sentence long. That's all, one sentence long, and with a footnote of two or three sentences. But the one sentence is women's liberation is the recognition of both women and men of the need and the right of each and every woman to assert herself. And to assert, put an asterisk down and I describe a few words about assert. It's one of my favorite verbs, and it means that you have an idea in your head and then you do it. You know? Mm-hmm. You don't not do it. If you have the idea in your head, do it. Okay. Will it benefit you or will it benefit the other person? That's a value judgment. And what are you talking about? Short term, mid term, or long term? How can you measure it? You just have to do it. I don't know. I mean, it's nothing I learned in a book and it's nothing I learned in a classroom. It's what I learned from traveling and life in the street and talking and late at night with friends and whatever. It's my own experiences. I had arrived at it independently, and then it was manifested in my relationship with others. I hope I've never been cruel or mean or unkind or unappreciative of anyone who's ever shared their time and energy and body with me. Well, London in the 60s and Europe, the world in the 60s and Europe in the 60s, but London in the 60s was very open to all kinds of experimentation. And I became a kind of sexual guru. Men and women came to me for counsel. I don't know why they did. And women would come to me about their troubles they were having with their boyfriend or their lover or whatever. And men would come to me, oh, my girlfriend has gone off with another guy or whatever, or she's jealous. I became a counselor because so many people were having these hang-ups, you know. I became very much involved in everyone's sex lives, trying to demystify it and eliminate pain, unnecessary pain that people suffered, which I thought was totally ridiculous for them to be suffering. They should be laughing and enjoying themselves. Basically, in London, I started something called the Arts Lab, and the Arts Lab was two warehouses in Covent Garden, and in which one of them was a theater. They were next to each other and connected to each other. And one was a cinema in the basement. I was moving in the right circles, and people wanted to meet me. Mm-hmm. People call up and invite me to dinner and things like that. Brian Epstein wanted to meet me, and he invited me to dinner with the Beatles. That's how I met them. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember how I met Mick. I mean, when I think of the amount of John Lennon stuff I could have had over the years and how much that stuff is going for now. Mm-hmm. All tapes and signatures and things, you know. I mean, I had somewhere at some point Sergeant Pepper signed by everybody, and it's disappeared. I didn't put it in a vault or anything. I just left it on a Well, I didn't treat it with any reverence, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, anything. I set up International Times with a borrowed, I don't know how much I borrowed, £125 or £200 from a friend in Paris, an American I knew in Paris who was rich. And I said, could I borrow this to start a newspaper? And that's the first printing bill paid at the time. Printing was cheap at the time, and everything was cheap. And I think we printed 10,000 copies. And I was one of the first street sellers. I actually enjoyed going out on the street selling, get, you know, copies. And later when the paper was doing quite well, I wanted to pay him back. And he refused. He said, no, I enjoyed being the one who loaned the money to start it. Implicitly, it was extreme libertarianism. You know, one should be able to consume anything you wanted, you know, one should be able to smoke anything or inject anything or look any way you want. Just, it was your life to do what you wanted with, you know. Mm-hmm. And that the duty of the state was to advise and to suggest, but ultimately it was each person's individual decision what they did with their life. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if the state says, look, if you smoke X cigarettes per day, you might get X. Mm-hmm. That's warning. But ultimately, you have to accept the warning or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's your right.
Yeah.
But I think that's the duty of the state. Mm-hmm. But they don't have the duty to lock you up because you do that. You know. I've been an anarchist, but in a rather specialized sense of the word. I've never been a bomb thrower. I've think that instead of hitting a policeman over the head, you invite him and his wife home for dinner. You know, I've not been much for demonstrations. And I've never been particularly right or left, although I'm probably more in sympathy with the left and would call myself, I guess, a liberal. But I'm a libertarian, of course, anti-censorship. I'm interested in demystification. That's my favorite word. So many things are mystified, like, well, two classic ones are like the word art. I don't think it exists. I think it's a lot of hooey. It's just media. A painting is a medium for storing and transmitting information, and to call it art is mystifying it. Why mystify it? I mean, it's just a painting. You give it some kind of specialized meaning which it doesn't have. You know, it's just a painting, and a piece of theater is just a piece of theater, and a film is a film, and a book is a book, and there's no really any good or bad. It's just is itself, and that if you like it, then it's, of course, it's a good book, but if you don't like it, then it's bad book, but it's neither good nor bad. It's just a book that you like or don't like. And that goes for everything, and especially for, I'm concerned, the so-called art world. It goes for that. You know, mainly it's how the rich in America stay rich. Mm-hmm. Everybody still buys into it. Mm-hmm. And why people are still buying into it, I don't understand. And also I find that people, what I find bizarre is that a lot of people who are painters and sculptors take themselves seriously as artists. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm an artist. Bullshit, you know? Come on. I remember reading Lawrence Durrell's Alexandria Quartet, the first one, Justine, and I read about 50 pages of it once, and I thought, oh, Christ, this is overwritten tosh, you know? It's overwritten tosh. And then later, I was in another location, and it was a different me, and I read it and loved it. So it all depends on where your head's at a particular moment in time. I can't believe that I thought it was tosh the first time I read it and loved it the second time, but I did, you know. And it goes for a movie, it goes for a person, it goes for anything you can have. I've always considered myself an earthling. I've never considered myself particularly an American. I've never been interested in national adjectives. They say, you know, well, you're English, you must like tea. Or you're French, you must drink wine. What if you don't like tea or drink wine? There's people planting these stereotypes on you. And I've said everyone in the world is unique. And this is what we all have in common, the fact that everyone is unique. And everyone has their own tastes, their own desires, their own aspirations, their own hopes, their own fears. And there might be overlapping, but ultimately everyone's experience is unique. It cannot be otherwise. We're born at different times in different places, and we have different friendships, and we make different travels, and we read different books and see different movies and have different all kinds of experiences. So that makes us unique. All our experiences form our value system. You know, and so we can only have a unique value system. And to try to mold that into a British system or an American system or something is pushing a square peg into a round hole or something. You know, it's impossible, but people do insist upon doing it. I mean, everyone wants to know, where are you from, you know? Yeah. Instead of saying, I'm interested in you, Thomas, tell me the story of your life, or tell me your adventures, or how did you become you, and tell me what you like and what you don't like. But no, they want to say, oh, you're French. That means therefore, check, check, check. It's bullshit. People like to belong to tribes, and they feel strength, and that's why the Olympic Games, and you know, oh boy, we won a gold medal. You didn't, that guy ran the, you didn't run it, you know. What do you mean we run it, you know? I find the when they do the flag and football game, you know, Chelsea won, we won, hooray. You know, who cares, you know? I made a world passport. It has nothing to do with nations. It's a world passport. It's a... world passport. That one. It actually had recognition. It had two forms of recognition, de jure and de facto. De jure was five countries accepted, and de facto about 65 countries accepted it. Poor countries accepted it, de jure, and de facto was many countries. I mean, I traveled only between Switzerland, Italy, and France in the early 70s. Oh, no, I don't travel. The world has changed, and I don't want to bring harassment. I mean, I've had some harassments due to it, you know. The situation has changed generally. I mean, for one thing, Western Europe and America have gotten more affluent, and everything's more expensive. Mm-hmm. And therefore, to do things, it's difficult now, whereas it was much easier earlier, I think. I might be saying that because I was in my 20s and 30s then, and now I'm not. But I do think that's a factor. I mean, when I worry about Paris as an intellectual and cultural center because it's so expensive to live here now, and I don't know how people pay the rent, you know. I mean, I live in this house because I managed to buy it, but if I didn't own it, I couldn't live here. I couldn't afford the rent, you know. For a long time, it's been pounded into our consciousness that the more stuff you have brings happiness. Probably the opposite is the case. The less stuff you have, the happier you are, probably. And so we accumulate all this junk, you know, whether it's books or films or DVDs or CDs or whatever, and we're weighed down by it, you know, and clothes and cars and, I mean, you know, I haven't owned, one of my definitions of happiness, I have a number of definitions, but one of my definitions of happiness is never wanting a car, owning or wanting a car. I haven't owned or wanted a car in 50 years now. And, you know, all these car advertisements just don't do anything to me at all. You know, oh, it's a new super, you can't give it to me. My classic definition of happiness is, some people say that when they're happy, they sing and dance. But I say, when I sing and dance, I am happy. And basically, it's saying that you have a duty to yourself to do something about your situation. So sing and dance, be happy, take a hot shower, make love, you know, whatever. You want a cure for your unhappiness? Get yourself a lover. So many people do enjoy their suffering. And it's, well, why not? Oh, Suck was in a way, Frappe le Bourgeois. You know, it was a kind of, let's make an outrageous newspaper. Mm-hmm. And there were many people involved, and they all had their own aims and reasons. Germaine Greer was involved, a guy called Willem de Ridder and Bill Levy and Suzanne Broger and Susan Jensen. Yeah, those are the main people. I guess the main three were Willem de Ridder, Bill Levy, and myself. Mm. And Heathcote Williams, a poet in London, and Germaine. For me, the idea was to demystify sexuality. I mean, like, one of the first events we did was a film festival. And it was an erotic film festival, the Wet Dream Film Festival in 1970 and 71. And we had a boat, which we sailed out into the North Sea. We sold 300 tickets, and people bought them from all over the world. And they were quite cheap, but it was one ticket for the whole week. And people came from Tokyo and New York and London and Berlin and, you know, for this. And it was great. It was fabulous. And we had a boat. We went out sailing in the North Sea, and we had love rooms on the boat. Any aspect, any form of sexual expression you wanted. I mean, if you wanted to, whatever you wanted to do, and if you had somebody else who wanted to do it with you, fine. And we had a lot of people wrote about it and talked about it, and it was in a way, it made a statement. I mean, and we did it. In a way, we did it 2 or 3 years. The third year we did a small one, but basically the 1970, 71 were big ones. Mm-hmm. Well, 300 people, week-long festival. Yeah, well, in a way, you can say we've won all the battles, mm-hmm. in a way. As far as censorship is concerned, I mean, pretty well anything goes. Mm-hmm. I still think that that the so-called sexual revolution, people missed the point. There's only a few people, I think, got the point. And that was that what the world needed was more of a personal concern for others. And the demystification of sexuality was just being able to hug other people without fear or without ridicule, without shame, without, you know, yeah, because they're a human being. And I actually said once that we should create hugatoriums, and we use churches, and there are two queues. And one queue, they go through the church, one queue is people who volunteer to hug others, and the other queue is people who want hugs. And it's always, you never know who you're going to get. It's like it's these queues of people going to be hugged. And I don't know, maybe, I don't know if I blame myself for any of this or not. Maybe I should or shouldn't, I don't know, or everyone. The whole kind of porn, more notches on your belt culture, you know, more fucking and more, you know, and no concern for the other person. I mean, I found that they had even clubs in New York where you could go and, you know, whatever, in California, whatever. I remember going to some in California. You don't even meet the other. You don't even know the other person's name. In Paris, there are plenty of them, too. You know, you can go to them. And it's just, it's anonymous sexuality. And while I don't mind anonymous sexuality, I want to know the other person. Know is a strange verb because no one can ever really know anyone. But one can be concerned for another person. And that's the concernness. I mean, caring about them. Does this give you pleasure? Are you happy? Or, you know, showing concern. And people are just concerned with their own needs and desires and not for the other person. I had the keys to two apartments, which meant I could go to Amsterdam anytime I wanted to. But I always lived in Paris. I had to leave London for various reasons. One, because of wanting to run the newspaper SOC, and I wanted to experience another city. And it was either going to be Amsterdam, Paris, or Barcelona. And finally, I settled on Paris because I was offered this position at the university. And I thought, well, you know, I turned it down when they first offered it to me. And they had the good sense or consideration to ask me twice. And I had the good sense to accept it the second time. And I became a professor for it. 30 years. And basically, I had an opportunity to develop and articulate some of my philosophical ideas to students who wanted to hear it. I owed my life in Paris to May 68 in many ways because the university that I was invited to be a visiting professor was a direct result of May 68. May 68 began at Nanterre University with students, a handful of students, who were complaining about classrooms too small, too crowded, subjects were irrelevant, professors were boring, subjects were uninteresting, etc., etc. And so they created this university, which is the one I was invited to participate, which were going to have a number of non-academics there, teaching in other languages besides French, but, you know, English and German, Arabic, whatever. And it was going to be an open university that you didn't have to have your back to go to it. Anyone could go to it if they had 2 years of work experience. And so it became a very wild place. Mm-hmm. And, pre-war Paris, it still existed a little bit in the 50s and 60s. But slowly materialism came in and money came in and all that. There were still popular quarters. I mean, you could get places to rent. My first flat where I lived for two years, I guess, was unbelievably beautiful. Unbelievably beautiful. And I paid 600 francs a month, which at the time was $100 a month. It was an incredibly beautiful place. And one nice story is that one day there's a knock on the door and there's this very lovely creature on the other side saying that she had read some of my essays and that she wanted me to teach her English. And I said, well, nothing I'd like better to do than to teach her English, but the best thing for you to do is to move in the house, move in, live here. And she said, are you kidding? And I said, no. She said, okay. She moved in, and she learned English, and we both explored each other's bodies every night. And one day, I couldn't pay the 600 francs rent, which is nothing. I mean, $100, I didn't have it. So I said, look, I'm going to call the landlady up on the phone and you tell her that you're my secretary and that I'm expecting a check from New York, which is coming any day now, and I'm going to be late, but don't worry, you know. So I dialed the number and I put the phone over to her. I said, your French is much better. My French was abominable then. It was 1970, you know, 30, 40 years ago. It's bad now, but it was really abominable. So she's speaking in her impeccable French of the story I told her to tell her. And then she starts laughing, hysterically laughing, and puts the phone down and says, don't worry about the rent. It was her mother's sister. Her aunt was my landlady, and we none of us knew it. She was living with me in her aunt's apartment. There I said, don't worry about the rent. And then, I had my bookshop in Edinburgh. Well, what took me to Edinburgh is I went in to do my military service. At the end of 2 years, I asked permission to be released from the military in Edinburgh. And to my delightful surprise, it was granted. And I continued to live in Edinburgh, but much more modestly, because when I'd been in the military, I had received an income. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, I have no income. But I had saved a little money, and the only way I thought of survival was to start a bookshop. So I started the so-called first all-paperback bookshop in Britain. Mm-hmm. And it was appropriately enough named the paperback. Well, because I had a gallery and a theater and coffee house in the same place. Mm-hmm. I was inspired by what I thought would be a great bookshop. It was my own. It was actually a perfect location. The old university was here. The new university was here, and I was in the middle between the two. So every day about, a few thousand students had to walk in front of the bookshop. And since I gave away free coffee and free tea, and the regular customers had their own private cups hanging on the rack in the back, they just went and made themselves a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, it attracted a large student clientele. And I gave the address of welcome every year to the freshman class. So I was quite a well-known character around Edinburgh and the university. So it was a very popular bookshop. And then on the ground floor, well, it was a ground floor and a basement. In the basement, I had a gallery. And on the ground floor, I had Hessian drapes, which could be dropped at night over the bookshelves. So it became a performance space. I did plays in the bookshop and concerts and book signings and whatever. So it was a hive of activity at all the time. And it was a much-loved institution. And when the university expanded between the... they connected the two parts of the... they knocked the whole block down. And many people were really, really upset in the city because of the bookshop was so popular. It was a major source, intellectual center in the city. It attracted people from all over Scotland and the north of Britain, and indeed Scotland, and indeed, you know, Oxford, Cambridge, and London, because I sold books that you couldn't get anywhere else in Britain. Many censored books and illegal books, whatever, like Tropic of Cancer and Fanny Hill and whatever, you know. But I sold D.H. Lawrence, Lady Chatterley, when it was banned, and a woman came in and heard... it said, I hear you're selling this book, and could I buy it? And I said, yes. And so she paid me. She said, I'll come back in 30 minutes to get it. And I smelt a rat, so I called a photographer friend of mine. I said, I think we're going to have some action. And she came back in 30 minutes. My photographer friend was there, and she picked up the book with a tong. She wouldn't touch it, and carried it outside, and poured kerosene on it and burned it. Wow. And ran it and raved. Meanwhile, he's snapping away, and the pictures went around the world. I sold books that were, I guess, were pursued my philosophical and political aims. Yeah. And I sold a lot of poetry, a lot of philosophy, and contemporary fiction and contemporary... Yeah, it was a great bookshop. It was really a great bookshop. I mean, I ran the bookshop because it was a fun thing to do. And I liked the idea of creating an ambiance, which was warm and welcoming. I met all my customers and knew their names and introduced them to people. And out of it came love affairs and marriages and babies, and not specifically for me, but for my customers. I remember I introduced a philosopher in Edinburgh that I liked to a woman that I liked, and now they've got kids, you know. How many booksellers do that? And now this university are putting up a sculpture or monument to the bookshop this August during the festival. I have to go and cut the ribbon. I mean, it's nice that people cared, you know. It's nice that people cared for what happened. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of history, but... I'm not very materialist-oriented. I like to think that I'm not materialist at all, but I do love this house. Mm-hmm. And I love this house because it enables me to do the Sunday dinners. It enables me to have guests, to be hospitable. And I've got nice neighbors, and I like the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I, by dumb luck, managed to buy it. And through actually the love of a girlfriend, she helped me. And... I introduced a French woman to an American writer, and they got married and had a son, and they lived in here before me. They had the house. I don't know how they got it. And they used to invite me to dinner because I was a friend of theirs. And I'd come here, and I just said every time I came here, I said, my God, it's so... I was living at the time in a great place, you know, so it wasn't... I mean, I was happy where I was living, but I kept saying, this is really fabulous, you know. I've got a great place, but you all also have a great place, basically. And then there was I heard rumors that they were going to demolish the place where I was living. It was being scheduled to be demolished. I was thinking that I'm going to have to find another place. And where was I going to find another place that was as good as where I was? And then they called me up one day and said they were moving to the south of France. And did I want it? And I said, yes, I'd love to have it. And they said, well, there's one catch. The woman who owned it is coming back in a year. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, Christ, I'll move in for a year and then have to move out again. And I said, yes, I'll do it. I'll take it. And then she, woman who owned it, said, oh, you can have it another year and you can have it. So I had 3 years renting it. And then one day she said, I'm never going to live there again. And I know you like it. Would you like to buy it? And I said, yes, of course I'd like to buy it. I didn't add that I had no money. But I did say I'd like to buy it. And I went looking for the money, and my bank agreed to give me a mortgage, which was, I was shocked that they did, but they did. I was taking out this French girl called Annie, and Annie was totally broke, and I paid for everything. There was no question of her ever. She had no money. And I had very little, but I had more than her. And so I bought every cinema ticket and every restaurant bill and every concert we went to and everything I paid, even metro tickets, I think I paid. I paid everything. And one day, it was about noon, there's a knock on my door and there's Annie at the door. And she said, I'm just in the neighborhood, I want a free coffee. You know, I want a coffee. And so I said, well, you've come to the right place. You know, and she comes in, I make her a coffee. And she said, how's everything? What's happening? What's the story? And I said, well, I'm Annie, I got a mortgage, but I'm still missing, and I named how many francs I was still missing. I don't know, 40,000 francs, something like that. I mean, quite a lot. And she pulled out a checkbook and wrote a check and handed it to me. And I said, Annie, is this a good check? I mean, is it going to bounce? I mean, where did you suddenly get money? Her grandmother died and left her some money. And she said, might as well use it. And that's how I got the place. Everything Is was probably written or conceived in the 70s. I can't remember the publication date, late 70s, early 80s. It's a kind of Zen Buddhist title in the sense that, life is, and it's everything. It's pain, it's joy, it's tenderness, it's treachery, it's violence, it's everything. Every human emotion, every human experience, life is. It contains everything. And it's up to us to deal with all this and to accept it. We have to accept it. I mean, you know, I can scream and shout as much as I want about illness and death, but it's it's coming. You know, I'm ill now. Mm-hmm. People talk about suddenly you're dying. We're dying the minute we're born. You can't dwell on it, otherwise it'll drive you crazy. I mean, I've known some really, really wonderful people who died amazingly young, and you think, what's the justice in that? You know, they didn't even get to their 20s or 30s, and yeah, they're dead. And then you see some shit who live longer, and you wonder what's the justice in that. I gave a talk once in Switzerland at a meeting of Swiss boarding schools, and they gave me the subject of my talk, which I didn't choose. They gave it to me, and the subject was understanding others. And I said to them that it's an impossible undertaking. You can't understand anyone. You can't understand yourself even. What you can do is tolerate yourself or others. Accept yourself or others, respect yourself or others, or love yourself or others. And those are the hierarchies, and that's it. Understanding. And the reason why you can't understand yourself or anyone else is one simple reason. It's that we're constantly evolving and changing. Mm-hmm. So which one are you talking about? Today's, this mm-hmm. morning's, yesterday's? We're different people every second.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, maybe I do understand myself this morning, but this afternoon I'm somebody different. Well, the workers of the world unite and stop working is an attempt to demystify the verb and noun work, to work and worker. Mm-hmm. I think that the word as the source of 70 years of Cold War, that communism is a linguistic mistake in the sense that, or the Cold War is a linguistic mistake. because we use the verb in contradictory sense, in the sense that if I said to you, I worked all week in the garden, unless you know me well, you don't know whether to say, oh, poor you, or congratulations. If I like gardening, then of course you should say, good for you, Jim. But if you know me and I hate gardening, you would say, oh, poor you. But it's the same verb to describe contradictory information. And language is supposed to be a precise tool. And so I decided to create a new verb. And I created the verb to Fuller. And that means to, in honor of Bucky Fuller, an optimistic philosopher I admire. And it means to spend energy joyfully. So I've never worked in my life. My whole life I've never worked. And all the jobs I've had, including 30 years at the university, was Fullering. And the first payment for Fullering is the joy of doing what you're doing. And the second payment can be money or experience or travel or whatever, you know. But work, the first payment for work is wage. You're a wage earner. And I think the goal is not to unite workers, but the goal is to eliminate work. And if we can't eliminate work, at least we can share it. And if everyone had to do some kind of compulsory military service, I don't say military service, but national service, where you give a year of your life to the community, and no one ever has to do shit jobs for the rest of their life. You know, you 1 year doing the terrible jobs, if there are terrible jobs. I mean, most jobs are not terrible. Mm-hmm. They're interesting. And also, there's the only other thing of why makes a job terrible, any job, even the nicest job can be terrible, if your job is demonstrating mattresses sleeping in a shop window. Yeah. That can be terrible after you have to do it every day, if you're obliged to do it. But if we can do some kind of where a kid 18 or 19 or something can give a year of his life so that collecting garbage or whatever is a part of his experience, then no one has to collect garbage the rest of their life. And my goal is to create a world of people who are happy doing what they're doing. They won't like what do. It's Tom Sawyer, yeah. Well, you know, all these people came here last night, 81 people, and it's a random selection of people from all over the world, and out of it come random meetings and encounters. And for me, I love the random factor. You take a stone, you throw it in a pond, and the ripples go out. Well, every encounter is a stone thrown into a pond. And from that encounter, these ripples, and you don't know the ramifications or how far the ripples are going to go out. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we're having this conversation now, or you meet someone at dinner last night, how is that going to have effect? We don't know what's going to happen. It's those things in life, you know, mm-hmm. these accidents that we don't, you know, I mean, I got on a bus in Edinburgh in 1959, and I heard two people speaking English but with an American accent, one row away from me, so I go over and start talking to them. I ended up living with the girl for about over a year, and the guy virtually built my bookshop for me. He was a shipbuilder, and he learned in the bus that I'm building a bookshop. He said, oh, I'll come up and give you a hand. Well, I ended up holding up the thing while he did everything. He was a builder. If I hadn't have gone up in there, I wouldn't have had the love affair with her. And it's because of her that I started the theater in Edinburgh. And it's because of him I created the bookshop. And it was only because I heard them speaking English on a bus. I could have just let them hear spoke English and not move my ass. I could have just sat in my seat and they got off their stop and I got off of my stop and that was that. But I moved. Which is what my definition of liberation is. You assert yourself. I got up and asserted myself, and because I asserted myself, things happen. I like the fact that from these dinners, I mean, who knows what's going to happen? I mean, there could be a guy here comes to dinner and he meets a girl, and then later she meets his brother and she marries him, but she doesn't marry him, but she marries his brother, mm-hmm. but because she met him here, you know, it's a total random factor because it's a mixture of 50, 60, 70, 80 people who come together mm-hmm. for 3 hours, you know. And some of them leave together and go off further for coffee and talking and whatever. I find myself slowing down quite a bit because I was a big walker and I could walk across Edinburgh or Paris like a bullet, you know, I was fast. And I would chide my friend, why are you so slow? Why can't you keep up? And it's me who's slow now, you know. And also aches my... I have aches in my knees and my legs and, you know, and Christ. It's the frailty of getting old, you know. I accept it and I fight against it both, you know. Of course I accept it because, I mean, I'm 78 or 79, I don't know. I'm 79 this year, I think. And I have a good friend, one of my dearest friends is 85. And another friend is in her low 80s, 83, I guess. She passes me by walking. I mean, she's fast, so Varda, fool. Well, I always said that basically one can have a philosophy and one can write about it and one can espouse it, but ultimately how you live is your real philosophy. And I've tried to live my ideals and my ideas in my daily life, the way I treat my fellow man and woman and friend and stranger and whatever.